We are Vineyard.
Somos Viña.
We are Vineyard.
The Desert Fathers and Mothers would talk about staying in your cell, which is a really big concept because the cell was the place they prayed. So it's staying at the rhythms and habits of faith, but it's also the place they worked. It's also the site of their community because they, even though we think of these guys as being hermits, most of them lived around other people and had practices together. But it is also the commitments of your life, the vows of your life, and the place, the geographical place you're in. And so it's this really comprehensive idea of staying, of remaining, of stability. And then just Benedict picked up that idea, and Benedictine monks now actually take a practice, a vow of stability. And we're not going to, you know, take that in the same way Benedictines do, but I do think that's still a helpful practice for the church, and a practice that we need, I think, pretty desperately we need to rediscover. And they would also talk about stabilitas cordis, stability of the heart, which became a really important idea to me of, like, what does it mean to cultivate stability of the heart, and how do we do that spiritually and practically?
Welcome to the We Are Vineyard podcast, conversations to help us grow with Jesus and each other. On today's episode, we have the second part of the conversation between Caleb Maskell and Tish Harrison Warren, an author and Anglican priest. Let's listen in.
I think your book is really important, and I'm also conscious that it's on a theme that, as I said earlier, like, a number of people are raising right now. Like, why do you think books like this, I'll just say, I think God is inspiring authors to remind the church of this stuff right now and to synthesize it into our culture, both for Christians and for people who are just discovering their own desire for God or for meaning. Why now? Is this, like, especially important to the moment that we're in now?
I don't know. I would love to hear your thoughts on that. I haven't thought about this on, like, a really kind of, I don't know, like global level of, like, why are we writing books on and retrieval of these things? I think part of it is the Enlightenment Project, I really do believe, James K. Smith writes about this, and lots of people have said, but I think he's right, is that it kind of perceived the human person as, like, a brain on the stick. And so for a long time, we thought about discipleship as, like, if we just get the right ideas in people's heads, their lives will magically change. And those ideas are the gospel, right? And that is something disconnected from our bodies or the material world. It's these, like, it's what Jesus did in time. But it's also, like, these ideas we hold in our head. You can put them in a systematic theology book. You can put them in a catechism. That's what we got to learn. That's it. And I think that doesn't work. I think the American church is a testament that it's not just a matter of putting the right ideas in people's head and people magically are sanctified.
You can have great theology and be a horrible, horrible person.
Yes. Have you met them? I've met some. Yeah.
Can you give me your top three examples? No.
Well, I'll just take my own life. I mean, one of the reasons I got interested in formation is that, you know, my husband and I were young and restless and reformed. And we, you know, were in a church in Harvard, like, right by Harvard, a lovely church with friends, still lovely friends there. It's a wonderful church. And I'm so grateful for it. And we were in a top seminary. We were spending our days learning Greek and Hebrew and reading the scriptures, deeply. And every elder at our church had a master's or PhD, was working at Harvard or MIT. I mean, we were in, like, the most intellectually, doctrinally, like, nourishing place we could possibly be. And we were, like, fighting like cats and dogs with each other. And we just were like, this isn't working, like, to change us. And so I got super interested in formation and how do people change over time? And what are we being formed by it? How are we formed? Now, I think that's absolutely in part by doctrine. I think that yes. formation and doctrine was really important.
Yes.
And I'm super grateful for it. It was very healing for my husband and I, who were both somewhat had backgrounds that were kind of anti-intellectual evangelical backgrounds. So it was great. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying it's not enough that we need orthodoxy, but also orthopraxis and sure. and what that looks like on like a regular Wednesday afternoon. And so I think some of this like retrieval of, you know, thinking about practices and formation that is getting popular, certainly in with John Mark and what mm-hmm. he's doing, but mm-hmm. is that humans really, really are more than brains on sticks. And the thing that made that showed us how much our subconscious practices are shaping our lives, I think, mm-hmm. in an unavoidable way, was that just digitization took over everything. And right. and the church was not prepared for it because we understand our many in the church, evangelicals, if I can speak for some of us, had this understanding that our battle was about worldview. But Apple Computers has never asked us to have a world like Steve Jobs never has asked me to recite a creed or to, you know, stand up and say, mm-hmm. I believe in Steve Jobs, maker of heaven and earth, or technology is the chief sure. end of man and enjoy, you know, the chief end of man is to enjoy, to know technology and enjoy it forever. It never asked us to change our beliefs, but it radically shaped how we use our time and our bodies and our attention. And turns out, that radically shapes actually things like where we see authority coming from and mm-hmm. our relationship with our church and our relationship with truth. And so yeah. we've seen massive changes in culture and in young people, but it wasn't because, you know, there was some like radically new belief system set up. It was a radically new praxis.
Put a new set of practices, the kind of the technological revolution of the last 20 years, say, just put a new set of practices in front of people, which began to shape and form them. It's got a set of ideas behind it, but they're yep. definitely implied, not explicit.
Exactly. Worldview there, it's all taught through practices.
And yeah. so it blows it in certain ways. It blows the church's commitment to things like worldview and doctrine as the spine. It yes. kind of blows it away because it says, well, if that's your spine, you're already doomed. And of course, we know that like the church is the most resilient institution in the world and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And here we all are. And for whatever reason, we continue to thrive and flourish generally most in the places where there's most persecution. And it seems like what's being attended to in your book and other books like it is that practices are the ways that Christians over time have learned to inhabit the gospel, however it comes to them, whether it comes to them initially as a theological framework or initially as a tradition they participate in their family or mm-hmm. some kind of encounter with God, mm-hmm. Whatever the case may be the way you come into this thing, practices are the inevitable way that your theology and your worldview and your commitments are going to be lived out, right? And what you're discovering in this book, I think, is that the early church or the desert fathers and mothers are sources of practical wisdom about practices that are shoring you up.
Yeah. Yes, and particular because the frame of my book, practices about how to sustain faith over a lifetime and over many different seasons of our life, particularly times when you're not feeling it. So yeah. if there's part of the church that was like, you know, it's all about getting the right ideas and the head, in our head. There's other parts of the church that is kind of like, it's all about feeling it. We got to get people to feel it. Like, you have to have a certain worship experience. We need a kick drum at just the right time so that the Holy Spirit falls at that moment. Because
dangerous.
And
what is your opinion on fog machines? Do you? just kidding.
I think fog machines are the evangelical longing for incense.
Yeah, all that. Now,
misappropriated.
During COVID, my very favorite satirical headline came from the Babylon Bee, and it said, "Nations churches distribute fog machines to families so that they can worship at home." And there was an image of a dad holding a baby on one hand and a fog machine on the other hand.
I love that.
Yeah,
that is great. Yes. Well done for whoever wrote that headline. That's very funny.
Yes.
So yeah, I think if it's about a certain kind of spiritual experience with God, then what about when it doesn't work anymore?
Yeah.
And then their whole life is spent seeking this experience instead of seeking God, because you've been told that is the presence of God, this particular subjective sense of experience. And so so doctrine wasn't enough, looking for that experience wasn't enough, but it wasn't enough then to just turn and kind of have this like evangelical, like, well, just keep it your quiet time. And that just wasn't robust enough for like, how do I do this? How do I keep going? So there is many practices that are, but the thing that helps me so much was the practice of stability, which is not something we talk about. Like, unless you're a Benedictine monk, you don't talk a lot about the practice of stability. And so part of this book is to introduce what that is. And then to distinguish that from just kind of like a stoic, suck it up and keep going, which I do not. I think the practice of stability is always hand in hand with like the continual conversion of all of our lives into who God is making us to be. And so stability, because you said talk about that, is this idea. The Desert Fathers and Mothers would talk about staying in your cell, which is a really big concept, because the cell was the place they prayed. So it's staying at the rhythms and habits of faith, but it's also the place they worked. Mm-hmm. It's also the site of their community, because they, even though we think of these guys as being hermits, most of them lived around other people and had practices together. Mm. But it is also the commitments of your life, the vows of your life, and the place, the geographical place you're in. And so it's this really comprehensive idea of staying, of remaining, of stability. And so I could say a lot more about that, but I think, and then just Benedict picked up that idea, and Benedictine monks now actually take a vow of stability. And we're not going to, take that in the same way Benedictines do, but I do think that's still a helpful practice for the church. And the practice that we need, I think, pretty desperately, we need to rediscover. And they would also talk about stabilitas cordis, stability of the heart, which became a really important idea to me of like, what does it mean to cultivate stability of the heart? And how do we do that spiritually and practically? So we've mentioned several times, I do think there's kind of an rediscovery in evangelical circles of practices, which I love. I think Liturgy of the Ordinary is hopefully part of that. And like, there's like Jared Boyd and John Mark Comer, and this is all really good. Mm-hmm. But I think not because of anything these guys or hopefully I are doing wrong, but because of just the state of American consumerism and evangelicalism, that you can take these practices And then it can become another consumer product of like, okay, so if I keep a Sabbath, then I'll live in bliss, or I'll
if I get the right sourdough at just the right moment and just the right wine and set it all up, then everything will work.
Yeah. If I pray in this way, then it will always be this blissful experience of the love of God, or, you know, everything will work. Maybe we know that doesn't mean that we'll like never have hardship or whatever, but we think our relationship, you know, our relationship with God becomes like a app. You know, you put in the right inputs and God has this guaranteed output. And
it's not a deal with God. Mm-hmm. Sabbath is not a deal with God.
Yeah. Right. So I wanted to bring the idea of stability into that conversation to say it's not just enough that we like recover practices of discipleship, but they're cumulative, so that we recover them like over really, really, really long periods of time, over decades. So at any given moment in that, it may seem like it doesn't seem like a lot is happening in my prayer life. Mm. It doesn't, you know, I'm trying to keep Sabbath and I'm trying to go to church, but I have a 2-year-old and a 5, you know, maybe even younger, 2-year-old and a 3-year-old. I know a family that has 4 kids, that has 3 kids under the age of 4, which I don't even know mathematically entirely how that's possible, but their Sabbath, they may not work, but I guarantee you that mom isn't experiencing a blissful rest every Sunday.
Right.
And so there's going to be times where it just feels like, oh my gosh, this is not working. This is not worth it. And there's times where our faith itself, like God, feels like this isn't working. Is this worth staying in? Am I doing it wrong? Is God punishing me for something? Or is this just like not real or not true? Like, is it worth staying in this?
Yeah.
And so I think I'm glad that people are rediscovering these ideas of practices, but we have to hold that with the practice of stability, that it isn't just doing them. It's doing them for long periods of time, and that they accumulate.
So let me ask you just a very practical pastoral question then. Like, one of the things that discourages people in their practices is when they continue to sin. I know that that has discouraged me in my practices. I actually wrote to this old monk about it, who wrote a book on John of the Cross, where I was like, what if you're experiencing the dark night of the soul, but you're also like as bad as you were? Is it the real thing? Or is it just a fake dark night of the soul? And I mean, honestly, it's a real question, because talking about practices over time, you can really wonder, like, have I just reset? Have I gone all the way back to the, like, how do you just speak as a pastor? How do you talk to people wrestling with that kind of thing?
All right. I have one observation and I have 2 stories, if that's okay.
It's perfect.
Here's my observation. And I think this is an observation on, like, it's not just my observation. This is written about in the tradition, is that actually it's partly this like stability, this staying in your cell, that what happens, part of the reason that we have to stay in our cell, is that it's so easy for us to externalize the problems in our life, externalize the issues in our life. So if only I had a better church, if only I had a nicer spouse, if only I had more better behaved kids, a nicer home, like a beautiful place to pray in my house, more money, I don't know, whatever, thinner, whatever it is, then I could really follow God. If I had more quiet, if I had more space, if I didn't have to work so hard. And I talk in the book about like the part of the reason the monks constantly said stay in your cell is it's this idea that like sin, the problem is not external, but it's not really until we get stuck in a place that we give up on trying to solve our problem by moving or finding a better, you know, partner or finding, you know, like to keep go, you know, and it's, but to turn inward and say, actually the problem's in me And this is the moment that God wants to meet me, not a different moment, but the moment I'm in. And so what does it mean to meet God in this moment? Mm-hmm. I think as we do that, we actually end up seeing more of our sin. Like the experience of stability reveals what the intricate underground pipeline of sin in our life that we just didn't see before. But it doesn't mean it wasn't there before. Mm-hmm. So I actually do think part of the good work of the desert is that it kind of starts to show you who you are. Mm-hmm. And maybe in our early excitement for Jesus, we couldn't take it. We couldn't, it would destroy us to see the brokenness inside of us. And so I think the Lord starts giving us glimpses of that. And so I do think like part of sanctification is you end up seeing that you're worse than you thought.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. I think the stories I was going to tell, I have a story in, so I have a chapter. It's really, here, pro tip to the reader. It's really, really important that if you read through chapter 3 in my book, that you read chapters 4 and 5 and probably 6 and 7, 8. Because the book is also cumulative. So I wrote Liturgy of the Ordinary where you could kind of put in at any point. You could you could start in chapter 6 if you wanted to. You'd miss some stuff, but it would be fine. But this, I really think if you get through chapter 3 and you stop my book, you'll actually have possibly a malformed understanding of what Christian stability is. Like, I say some stuff, and then I say some more stuff that moderates and modifies the stuff I said. Maybe not moderates it, I don't think so, but modifies what I said. Mm-hmm. So you have to keep reading. But chapter 5 is about grace, and there's this story in it I love. If I had a book, I would just read it. Can I read it? Am I allowed to read from my book?
You are absolutely allowed to read from your book.
I wasn't planning on this. This is my son's illustrated version. See?
Excellent.
Yay.
Perfect.
But, I'm just going to read it because I don't think I can do better than it. And it, so it's the story that's so similar to what you're saying. It says, a brother fell when he was tempted, so he sinned. He blew it, right? And in his distress, he stopped practicing his monastic rule because he was like, oh, I'm seeing all of this sin. This isn't working. Yeah. I'm not good enough for this. He really longed to take it up again, but his own misery prevented him. He would say to himself, when shall I be able to be holy in the way I used to be before? Which is like the way you feel in the middle of this. So he went to see one of the old men and told him all about himself. And when the old man learned of his distress, he said, there was a man who had a plot of land, but it got neglected and turned into waste ground, full of weeds and brambles. So he said to his son, go and weed the ground. And the son went off to weed it, saw all the brambles and despaired. And he said to himself, how long will it take before I have uprooted and reclaimed all that? So he laid down and went to sleep for several days.
Yeah, relatable.
This is what I'm saying. This is 1700 years old. That's so relatable. He like goes to sleep for several days like a meme. And then his father came to see how he was getting on and found he had done nothing at all. Why have you done nothing? He said. The son replied, Father, when I started to look at this and saw how many weeds and brambles there were, I was so depressed that I could do nothing but lie down on the ground. His father said, Child, go over the surface of the plot every day and you will make some progress. So he did. And before long, the whole plot was weeded. The same is true for you, brother. Work just a little bit without getting discouraged. And by his grace, God will reestablish you. But here's what I like about
that.
It's beautiful. But it wasn't, well, keep working so you can earn God's mercy. It's that God, if you noticed, and when I said God's grace is what reestablishes. But it was God's grace reestablishes. So do a little effort without discouragement. And I just love that idea that it's not, It's all grace. I mean, I do think it's all grace. I think it's 100% grace. But it's not, it's all grace, man. So just don't worry about it. And it, but it's also, you know, don't worry about your sin.
Yeah.
But it's also not like, man, it's not working, Caleb. Like, I'm sorry. I guess you're not praying right because you're still sinning. It's the idea of like, no, there really, really, truly are so many weeds and brambles. And if you look at it all, you're going to despair. But it's God's grace that's reestablishing the land. So the invitation to you is just to I love to just take up a little effort without discouragement. Like, so that's one story. And then the other story I'll just tell, but hopefully make it shorter, is that there is another story in the desert. So I was worried about reading the Desert Fathers and Mothers because I thought they would be like, the theological word was like Pelagian. I thought they would all be Pelagian, like works righteous, like this is all on us to save ourselves. And there
like
is
the guy in the Da Vinci Code who beats himself.
Yeah. And there's honestly some of that. There is some, there, like the Desert Fathers were not all the same. And there's a little bit of that. And there's moments I'm like, oh, I have to get off the train here. Like, these people are not Jesus. And sometimes they're just like, I think some of them had some issues. So,
I love it. Yeah.
So, that said, what struck me reading them is I kind of came in expecting that. And there's so much talk of grace. There's so much talk of mercy. Like, shout out to our friend Dave Zoll.
Totally.
There is, you, he would, there would be some Dave Zoll approved Desert Fathers and Mothers. Not all of them, but some of them. And but the story is one, this is the story about this monk who was in the desert in a cell praying, and he just kept struggling with lust, specifically the sin of lust. And he goes to this hermit and confesses his sin. And the hermit is like shocked and is basically like, you're too much of a sinner to be a monk. And like, so this guy gets super discouraged and starts, and he leaves the cell. He like leaves his monastic life. He's walking out of the desert back to civilization to like give it up, basically. And on the way, he meets Abba Apollo, which who is this like very revered. This is Tim Keller. This is whoever, Wimber. Like this is the guy, super revered elder. And the elder sees he's upset and eventually basically like coaxes this guy to tell him everything. And so the guy just comes clean and tells him about his struggle with lust. And this like revered guy said, basically, I'm more spiritually advanced than you. Like, I've been doing this a lot longer and I am older and wiser. And I still struggle with the things you're saying. I am not free of the lust that you're speaking of. This would be like, think of the person you most respect in the spiritual life being like, yeah, I struggle.
Mind boggling moment. Yeah.
And he said, it is not by our efforts that we can be made whole, but by God's mercy alone. Therefore, go back to your cell and be a monk. And I just love the story because it's like, it's all mercy. Like, he saw his sin. He said, your sin is still there. It's all mercy. But then he wasn't like, it's all mercy. So like, give it up and like, stop, like, go back. Like, it was like, it's all mercy. So go back to your cell. So even the like call to stability is not in order to earn. It's like, you know, it's not for love, it's from love.
That's beautiful. Yes. Yeah. That's beautiful. I mean, it's all mercy, so keep trying.
Yeah.
Which is so great. I mean, it's like how Jesus restores Peter in that way as well. I mean, I've thought a lot about how when people become older, you know, I have aging parents and I know you do too. And they like people either they become more like themselves and become more like what they know often. And so some people, as they get older, become more merciful, and other people, as they get older, become more crotchety. And I've genuinely wondered about that in relationship to the fruit of the spirit of gentleness. Like, how do we become gentle? I wonder if we become gentle when, having passed through this journey of the middle of life that you've been talking about and you talk about so much in this book, what you discover is that you still need mercy at the end, but now you've known yourself well enough that you can give it as well as receive it.
Oh, I love that.
I mean, what a tender possibility it would be to think of Christian maturity. I mean, is it, there's not a difference between being correct and being merciful. In fact, to be the most merciful is to be the most correct if you're in step with the Spirit, right? So I love your stories. I really, really love what you're saying. Well, Tish, I hope people have heard enough from you to want to go out and read your book and not stop at chapter 3, but get all the way through to the end, because we wouldn't want them to be malformed by not reading the whole thing.
And some Christian books, you really can just read the first three chapters and get the gist. This isn't one of them.
It's very, very helpful to hear that. And I'm really grateful for you and thankful that you write. And I hope a lot of people will read this book. It's been super great talking to you.
Yes, I'm so thankful for you, Caleb. Thank you.
We Are Vineyard is grateful for the sponsors that make this podcast possible. Have you ever wished that there's a way to help the girls in your church grow in their faith while connecting to generations of women? That's the vision behind Vessels. Vessels is a place for girls in grades 3 through 6, where faith, fun, and biblical truth come together. More like a club than a classroom, it combines engaging Bible teaching, crafts, jewelry, music, and authentic relationships that help girls discover their God-given value, purpose, and identity. At the same time, Vessels creates opportunities for women and girls to build meaningful relationships across generations, strengthening both along the way. Now, personally, my daughters have absolutely loved being a part of Vessels. I've been so impressed by the depth of what they're learning each week. It's helping them build a strong foundation of following Jesus, memorizing scriptures, and discovering who God made them to be. Vessels clubs launch each fall, which means now is the perfect time to explore bringing a club to your church. To learn more about Vessels and what it looks like to launch a club in your community, visit godsvessels.com and schedule a conversation. That's godsvessels.com. The next generation won't be discipled by accident. Let's be intentional. Do you ever feel just scattered? Whether you're an established church or just starting out, Planning Center helps you connect every ministry and sync every detail. From volunteer schedules and kids check-ins to donations and event signups, then you can feel at ease knowing things are in their right place. Get started for free today at planningcenter.com.
What if the communities you're building could only be as healthy as you are? Better Together is back, and this year we're going deeper. Join Vineyard USA Associations July 21st through 23rd at North Jersey Vineyard for a transformational gathering where beloved community meets emotionally healthy leadership. Featuring Drew Hyun from Emotionally Healthy Discipleship, you'll discover how to lead from wholeness instead of woundedness and build communities where people don't just attend, they truly belong. This isn't just another conference. It's a reset for your soul and a vision for the community God's called you to lead. Early bird pricing is available through May 4th. So don't wait. Learn more and register today at bettertogether.vineyardusa.org. We'll see you there.